Chapter 3. The tense minutes passed in total silence, minutes before Pitt could bring himself to say anything that was important. When at last he did, his voice sounded to him like a vague whisper. Why whisper, he thought. Honeywell was probing the ice 30 feet away. The Russian submarine, now riding motionless on the surface, lay a quarter of a mile from the northern edge of the iceberg. Finally, Pitt managed to attract Honeywell's attention with a voice that was still hushed by the cathedral-like silence. "Time's running out, Doc." It still seemed he might be overheard, though the Russians couldn't have picked up his words had he shouted at the top of his voice. "I'm not blind," Honeywell snapped. "How long before they get here?" By the time they set a dinghy in the water, row in from the sub and step ashore, 400 yards if it's an inch, it'll take them between 15 and 20 minutes. "We've no damned time to lose," Honeywell said impatiently. "Any luck yet?" "Nothing," Honeywell boomed back. "The derelict must be deeper than I thought." He rammed the probe feverishly into the ice. "It's here. It's got to be here. 125-foot vessel couldn't have disappeared. Maybe the Coast Guard saw a phantom ship." Honeywell paused to adjust his sunglasses. The ice patrol crew might have been fooled by their eyes, but not by their radar equipment. Pitt moved closer to the open door of the helicopter. His gaze swung to Honeywell, then back to the sub, and a second later he was peering through the binoculars. He studied the tiny figures that were erupting from the hatches of the low-silhouetted submarine and scrambling hurriedly across the sea-splashed deck. In less than 3 minutes, a large 6-man dinghy was inflated, dropped beside the hull, and boarded by a group of men carrying an assortment of automatic weapons. Then an indistinct popping sound came over the rolling blue water. The sound was enough. Enough for Pitt to drastically cut his original time estimate. "They're coming. 5, maybe 6 of them. Can't tell for sure." "Are they armed?" Honeywell's query sounded urgent. "To the teeth." "My God, man," Honeywell shouted irritably, "don't just stand there and gawk. Help me search for the derelict." "Forget it." Pitt's tone was unhurried. "They'll be here in another 5 minutes."
5 minutes, you said?"
"I didn't count on their dinghy having an outboard motor." Honeywell stared stricken at the submarine. "How did the Russians find out about the derelict? How could they have possibly known the location?"
"No great feat," Pitt answered.
"One of their KGB agents in Washington undoubtedly got hold of the Coast Guard sighting report. It's hardly a classified secret. And then dispatched every fishing trawler and submarine they had in this part of the Atlantic to search the ice field. It's an unfortunate coincidence for us, but a lucky one for them that we both discovered the iceberg at the same moment."
"It looks as if we've thrown the ball game," Honeywell said bleakly. "They've won and we've lost. Damn it, if we could only locate the derelict's hull, we could at least destroy it with thermite bombs and keep it out of the Russians' hands."
"To the victor goes the spoils," Pitt murmured. "All 1,000,000 tons of the finest, purest, genuine Greenland ice in the Atlantic Ocean." Honeywell was puzzled, but said nothing. Pitt's apparent indifference made no sense.
"Tell me, Doc," Pitt continued, "what's today's date?"
"The date?" Honeywell said dazedly. "It's Wednesday, March 28th. "We're early," Pitt said. "3 days early for April Fool's Day." Honeywell's voice was flat and hard.
"This is hardly the time or place for levity."
"Why not?"
"Somebody's played a tremendous joke on us and on those clowns out there."
Pitt gestured toward the rapidly approaching landing party. "You, I, the Russians, we're all starring in the greatest laugh riot ever to hit the North Atlantic. The climax of the final act comes when we all learn that there is no derelict in this iceberg."
He paused to exhale a cloud of smoke.
"As a matter of fact, there never was one." Total incomprehension and the meager beginnings of hope touched Honeywell.
"Go on," he prompted.
"Besides radar contact, the crew of the patrol plane reported that they sighted the outline of a ship in the ice, yet we saw nothing before we touched down. That alone doesn't figure. They were in an aircraft flying at a probable patrol speed of 200 miles an hour. If anything, our chances of spotting something from a hovering helicopter were far higher."
Honeywell looked thoughtful. He seemed to be weighing what Pitt had said.
"I'm not sure what you're hinting at." Then he smiled. Suddenly his old, cheerful self again.
"But I'm getting wise to your sly mind. You must have something up your sleeve."
"No magic. You said it yourself. By every known law of current and drift, this berg should be floating 90 miles to the southwest."
"True."
Honeywell looked at Pitt with a new respect.
And the conclusion, exactly what do you have in mind?
Not what, but who, Doc?
Someone who is leading all of us on the proverbial wild goose chase. Someone who removed the red dye from the iceberg containing the lost ship and spread more of the same over a decoy 90 miles off the track.
Of course. The iceberg we flew over hours ago. The same size, configuration, and weight, but no red stain.
That's where we'll find our mystery ship, said Pitt. Right where you calculated it was supposed to be.
But who's playing games? Honeywell asked, his face set in a contemplative twist.
Obviously it isn't the Russians. They're as confused as we are.
At the moment it doesn't matter, Pitt said. The important thing is to bid fond farewell to this floating ice palace and fly off into the blue. Our uninvited guests have arrived.
He nodded down the slope of the berg.
Or perhaps you hadn't noticed?
And Honeywell hadn't. But he noticed it now. The first of the landing party from the submarine was leaping onto the edge of the ice. Within a few seconds, five of them came piling on the berg, walking cautiously in Pitt and Honeywell's direction. They were dressed in black, Russian Marines, and heavily armed. Even at 100 yards, Pitt could discern the unmistakable look of men who knew exactly what they were out to do. Pitt casually climbed aboard the helicopter, turned the ignition switch, and pushed the starter. Even before the rotor blades swung into their first revolution, Honeywell was ensconced in the passenger's seat with his safety belt tightly secured. Before he closed the door to the cockpit, Pitt leaned out, cupped both hands to his mouth, and shouted to the advancing Russians, "Enjoy your stay, but don't forget to pick up your litter." The officer leading the men from the submarine cocked an ear, then shrugged uncomprehendingly. He was certain that Pitt was hardly likely to shout in Russian for his benefit. As if to signal the occupants of the helicopter of his peaceful intentions, the officer lowered his automatic weapon and waved a salute as Pitt and Honeywell relinquished possession of the iceberg and rose into the radiant blue sky. Pitt took his time, keeping the helicopter at a minimum cruising speed and holding on a northward course for 15 minutes. Then, after they were out of sight and radar range of the submarine, he swung around in a long circle to the southwest, and by 11:15 they had found the derelict. As they bore down on the great ice giant, Pitt and Honeywell shared a strange sense of emptiness. It wasn't just the end of the long hours of uncertainty. They were already past the time limit set by Commander Kosky. It was the eerie appearance of the mystery ship itself. Neither man had ever seen anything quite like it. The atmosphere around the berg had a terrifying desolation that belonged not to Earth, but to some dead and distant planet. Only the rays of the sun broke the inertness, penetrating the ice and distorting the lines of the ship's hull and superstructure into a constantly changing series of abstract shadows. The sight seemed so unreal that it was difficult for Pitt to accept the visible fact of its existence. As he adjusted the controls and lowered the helicopter to the ice, he half expected the entombed vessel to vanish. Pitt tried to land on a smooth spot near the berg's edge, but the sloping angle of the ice proved too great. He finally put down directly on top of the derelict. Honeywell leaped from the helicopter just before the skids kissed the ice, and had already paced the derelict from bow to stern when Pitt joined him.
"Odd," Honeywell murmured. "Most odd. Nothing protrudes above the surface, not even the masts and radar antenna. Every square inch is sealed solidly under the ice."
Pitt pulled a handkerchief from his flight jacket and blew his nose. Then he sniffed the air as if testing it. "Smell anything out of the ordinary, Doc?" Honeywell tilted his head back and inhaled slowly.
"There is something of an odor. Too faint, though. I can't make it out."
"You don't travel in the right circles," Pitt said, grinning. "If you'd get out of your laboratory more often and learn a bit about life, you'd recognize the distinct aroma of burnt rubbish."
"Where's it coming from?"
Pitt nodded at the derelict under his feet.
"Where else but down there?"
Honeywell shook his head.
"No way. It's a scientific fact. You can't smell an inorganic substance inside a block of ice from the outside.
The old proboscis never lies." The midday warmth was beginning to overcome the cold, so Pitt unzipped his flight jacket.
"There must be a leak in the ice."
"You and your educated nose," Honeywell said acidly. "I suggest you stop playing bloodhound and start placing the thermite charges. The only way we're going to get inside the wreck is by melting the ice mantle."
"We'll be taking a risk."
"Trust me," Honeywell said mildly. "I'm not about to split the berg and lose the derelict, the helicopter, and ourselves as well. I intend to begin with small loads and work our way down by degrees. I wasn't thinking of the iceberg. I was thinking of the wrecked ship. There's a damn good chance the fuel tanks have ruptured and allowed diesel oil to slosh the entire length of the keel. If we miscalculate and ignite as much as a drop, the whole derelict goes up in one fiery puff. Honeywell stamped his foot on the hard-packed ice. How do you expect to get through that with an ice pick?
Dr. Honeywell, Pitt said quietly, I won't argue the fact that your name is known far and wide for your hyper-scientific intellect. However, like most super-brains, your mental depth for practical everyday run-of-the-mill matters is sadly lacking. Thermite charges. Ice picks, you say. Why bother with complex and muscle-exerting schemes when we can simply perform an open sesame routine?
You're standing on glacial ice, Honeywell said. It's hard and it's solid. You can't walk through it.
Sorry, my friend. You're dead wrong, Pitt said.
Honeywell eyed him suspiciously.
Prove it. What I'm getting at is the labor has already been done. Our Machiavelli and his merry band of busy helpers have obviously been here before us. He pointed dramatically upward. Please observe.
Honeywell lifted a quizzical eyebrow and looked upward and intently studied the broad face of the steep ice slope. Along the outer edges and near the lower base, only a few yards from where Pitt and Honeywell stood, the ice was smooth and even. But beginning at the summit and working downward into the middle of the slope, the ice was as pockmarked as the backside of the moon.
Well now, Honeywell murmured, it does appear that someone went to a lot of trouble to remove the ice patrol's red dye stain.
He gave a long, expressionless look at the towering ice pinnacle, then turned back to Pitt.
Why would someone chip the stain out by hand when they could have easily erased all trace with explosives?
I can't answer that, Pitt said. Maybe they were afraid of cracking the berg, or maybe they didn't have explosives, who can say? However, I lay a month's wage that our clever little pals did more than merely chip ice. They most certainly found a way to enter the derelict. So all we do now is look for a flashing sign that says, Enter here.
Honeywell's tone was sarcastic. He wasn't used to being outguessed, and his expression showed that he didn't like it.
A soft spot in the ice would be more appropriate.
I suppose, Honeywell said, you're suggesting a camouflaged cover over some sort of ice tunnel.
The thought had crossed my mind. The doctor peered over the top of his glasses at Pitt.
Let's get on with it, then. If we stand around here theorizing much longer, my testicles will probably get an acute case of frostbite.
It shouldn't have been all that difficult, not by a long shot. Yet it didn't go as easily as Pitt had figured. The unpredictable occurred when Honeywell lost his footing on the slope and slid helplessly toward a steep ledge that dropped into the icy sea. He fell forward, desperately clawing at the ice, his nails scratching and bending painfully backward through the hard surface. He slowed momentarily, but not enough. His fall happened so abruptly that his ankles were already scraping the edge of the 30-foot drop before he thought of shouting for help.
Pitt had been busily prying up a chunk of loose ice when he heard the cry. He swung around, took in Honeywell's deteriorating plight, had a lightning impression of how impossible rescue would be once the doctor had fallen into the freezing water, and in one swift movement tore off his flight jacket and flung himself across the slope in a flying leap, feet first, legs lifted crazily in the air. To Honeywell's panic-flooded brain, Pitt's move looked like an act of pure madness.
"Oh, God, no, no!" he shouted.
But there was nothing he could do but watch Pitt hurtle toward him like a bobsled. There might have been a chance, he thought, if Pitt had stayed on the berg. Now it seemed certain that both men would die in the freezing salt water together.
25 minutes, Commander Kosky's words flashed through his head. 25 minutes was all a man had to remain alive in 40-degree water. And with all the time in the world, they never could have pulled themselves back onto the sheer sides of the iceberg. If he'd had precious moments to think about it, Pitt would have undoubtedly agreed with Honeywell. He surely looked like a madman skidding over the ice with his feet high above his head. Suddenly, with only a leg's length remaining before he collided with Honeywell, Pitt brought his feet flashing down with a power and swiftness that, even in these desperate circumstances, made him grunt in pain as his heels crashed through the ice, dug in tenaciously, and brought him to a muscle-jarring stop. Then, as if triggered by instinct, in the same motion he threw a sleeve of his jacket to Honeywell. The thoroughly frightened scientist needed no coaxing. He grasped the nylon fabric with a grip that no vice could have equaled and hung on, trembling for almost a minute, waiting for his middle-aged heart to slow down to a few beats above normal. Fearfully, he stole a glance sideways and saw what his numbed senses could not feel. The edge of the ice ledge cut across his waist at the navel. "When you're up to it," Pitt said, his voice calm but pierced with a noticeable trace of tenseness, "try pulling yourself toward me." Honeywell shook his head.
"I can't," he murmured hoarsely. "It's all I can do to hold on."
"Can you find a foothold?" Honeywell didn't answer. He only shook his head again. Pitt bent over between his outstretched legs and tightened his grip on the jacket. "We're sitting here through the courtesy of two hard rubber heels, not steel cleats. It won't take much for the ice to crack around them." He flashed an encouraging grin at Honeywell. "Make no sudden movement. I'm going to pull you clear of the ledge." This time Honeywell nodded. He felt a sick ache in his stomach. The tips of his torn fingers throbbed. His sweat-soaked face reflected the terror and pain. One thing, and one thing only, reached through his blanket of fear: the determined look in Pitt's eyes. Honeywell stared at the lean, tanned face, and in that moment he knew that Pitt's inner strength and confidence were gaining a toehold in his own frightened mind.
"Stop your blasted grinning," he said faintly, "and start pulling."
Cautiously, an inch at a time, Pitt hauled Honeywell slowly upward. It took him an agonizing 60 seconds before he had Honeywell's head on a plane between his knees. Then Pitt, one hand at a time, let go of the jacket and grabbed Honeywell under the armpits. "That was the easy part," Pitt said. "The next exercise is up to you." His hands free, Honeywell wiped a sleeve across his sweaty brow.
"I can't make any guarantees."
"Your dividers, are they on you?" Honeywell's expression went blank for a moment. Then he nodded.
"Inside breast pocket."
"Good," Pitt murmured. "Now climb over me and stretch out full length. When your feet are solidly on my shoulders, take out the dividers and jam them into the ice."
"A piton," Honeywell exclaimed, suddenly aware. "Damned clever of you, Major."
Honeywell began hauling himself over Pitt's prostrate form, straining like a locomotive climbing the Rockies, but he made it. Then, with Pitt's hands firmly clamped on his ankles, Honeywell pulled out the steel-pointed dividers that he normally used for plotting distances on charts and rammed them deeply into the ice.
"Okay," Honeywell grunted.
"Now we'll repeat the process," Pitt said. "Can you hold on?"
"Make it quick," Honeywell answered. "My hands are nearly numb."
Tentatively, one heel still embedded in the ice as a safety measure, Pitt tested his weight on Honeywell's legs. The dividers gripped firm. Working as swiftly and as smoothly as a cat, Pitt crept past Honeywell, felt his hands grope over the edge of the slope where it leveled out, and wiggled up onto safe ground. He didn't waste an instant. Almost immediately, it seemed to Honeywell, Pitt was throwing down a nylon line from the helicopter. Half a minute later, the pale and exhausted oceanographer sat on the ice at Pitt's feet. Honeywell gave a great sigh and gazed into Pitt's relieved face.
"Do you know what I'm going to do first thing we set foot in civilization?"
"Yes," Pitt said, smiling. "You're going to buy me the finest gourmet dinner in all Reykjavik, round up all the booze I can drink, and introduce me to a sensuous, buxom Icelandic nymphomaniac."
"The dinner and the booze are yours. I owe you that much. The nymphomaniac I can't promise. So many years have passed by since I've negotiated for a woman's charms, I'm afraid I've lost the touch."
Pitt laughed, clapped Honeywell on the shoulder, and helped him to his feet.
"Don't sweat it, old friend. Girls are my department."
He stopped abruptly and said sharply, "Your hands look like you held them against a grindstone." Honeywell lifted his hands and stared indifferently at the bleeding fingers.
"Not really as bad as they look. A bit of antiseptic and a manicure, and they'll be as good as new."
"Come on," Pitt said. "There's a first aid kit in the copter. I'll fix them up for you." A few minutes later, as Pitt tied the last small bandage, Honeywell asked, "Did you find any sign of a tunnel before I took my spill?"
"It's a slick piece of work," Pitt replied. "The entire circumference of the entrance cover is beveled, a perfect match with the surrounding ice. If someone hadn't got careless and cut a small hand grip, I'd have walked right over it."
Honeywell's face suddenly grew dark.
"This accursed iceberg," he said grimly. "I swear that it bears a personal enmity against us."
He flexed his fingers and solemnly studied the 8 little bandages masking the tips. His eyes seemed strained and his face looked weary. Pitt walked over and raised a round slab of ice 3 feet in diameter by 3 inches thick. revealing a crudely carved tunnel barely large enough for one man to crawl through. Instinctively, he turned his head away. A powerful, acrid stench of burnt paint, fabric, and fuel, mingled with torched metal, rose from the opening.
"That should prove I can detect smells through an ice cube," Pitt said.
"Yes, you've passed the nose test," Honeywell said smugly. "But you failed miserably on your thermite charge theory. That's nothing but a burned-out hulk down there."
He paused to give Pitt a scholarly gaze over the tops of his spectacles.
"We could have blasted until next summer without doing any damage to the derelict."
Pitt shrugged. "Win a few, lose a few." He passed a spare flashlight to Honeywell.
"I'll go first. Give me 5 minutes before you follow."
Honeywell crouched at the edge of the ice tunnel as Pitt knelt to enter.
"Two. I'll give you 2 minutes, no more, then I'll be right behind you."
The tube, illuminated by the shattered rays of the sun through the ice crystals above, ran downward at a 30-degree angle for 20 feet, stopping at the blackened steel plates, charred and bent, of the hull. The smell by this time was so strong that Pitt found it an effort just to breathe. He shook off the irritating odor and dragged himself to within a foot of the fire-scarred metal, discovering that the tunnel curved and paralleled the hull for another 10 feet, ending finally at an open hatch, savagely twisted and distorted. He could only wonder at the white-hot temperatures responsible. Crawling over the jagged edge of the hatchway, he stood up and swung the beam of his flashlight, surveying the heat-defaced walls. It was impossible to tell what purpose the compartment served. Every square inch was gutted by the terrible intensity of the fire. Pitt suddenly felt a dread of the unknown. He stood dead still for several moments, forcing his mind to regain control of his emotions before he stepped across the debris toward the door leading to the alleyway and shone the light into the darkness beyond. The beam touched the whole black length as far as the stairway to a lower deck. The corridor was barren except for the charred ashes of a carpet. It was the silence that was eerie. No creaking of the plates, no throb of the engines, no lapping of water against a weed-encrusted hull. Nothing. Only the complete soundlessness of a void. He hesitated in the doorway for a long minute. His first thought, conviction rather, was that something had gone terribly, terribly wrong with Admiral Sandecker's plans. This wasn't what they had been led to expect at all. Honeywell came through the hatchway and joined him. He stood next to Pitt, staring at the blackened walls, the distorted and crystallized metal, and the melted hinges that once held a wooden door. Wearily, he leaned against the doorway, his eyes half closed, shaking his head as if coming out of a trance.
"We'll find precious little that's of any use to us."
"We'll find nothing," Pitt said firmly. "What the fire left, our unknown friends have undoubtedly picked clean." As if to emphasize his words, he played the beam on the deck, revealing several overlapping footprints in the soot traveling to and from the open hatchway. "Let's see what they've been up to." They went out into the alleyway, stepping through the ashes and debris on the deck, moved to the next compartment, and entered. It had been the radio room. Most of the ruins were scarcely recognizable. The bunk and furniture were skeletons of charred wood. The remains of the radio equipment one congealed mess of melted metal and hardened drippings of stained solder. Their senses by now had become accustomed to the overpowering stench and the grotesque carbonized surroundings, but they weren't the least bit prepared for the hideously misshapen form on the deck.
"Oh, good God!" Honeywell gasped.
He dropped his flashlight and it rolled across the deck and came to rest against the shockingly disfigured remains of a head, illuminating the skull and teeth where they burst from the incinerated flesh.
"I don't envy him his death," Pitt murmured.
The ghastly sight was too much for Honeywell. He staggered off into one corner and retched for several minutes. When he finally returned to Pitt's side, he looked as if he'd recently returned from the grave.
"I'm sorry," he said sheepishly. "I've never seen a cremated corpse before. I didn't have the vaguest idea what one looked like. Never gave it much thought, really. It's not a pretty sight, is it?"
"There's no such thing as a pretty corpse," Pitt said. He was beginning to feel a touch of sickness himself.
"If that lump of ashes on the deck is any indication of things to come, we should find at least 14 more just like it."
Honeywell grimaced as he stooped and picked up his flashlight. Then he slipped a notebook from a pocket, held the light under his arm, and flipped through several pages.
"Yes, you're right. The ship sailed with 6 crewmen and 9 passengers, 15 in all. He fumbled a little before finding another page. This poor devil must be the radio operator. Svendborg. Gustav Svendborg. Maybe, maybe not. The only one who can tell for certain is his dentist. Pitt stared at what had once been a breathing, flesh-and-blood man, and he tried to imagine how the end had come. A furnace-like wall of red and orange flame, a brief, unearthly scream, the searing shock of pain that drove the mind into instant insanity, and the limbs flailing in the contorted dance of death. To die by fire, he reflected, the last seconds of life spent in indescribable agony, was an extinction abhorred by every living man and beast. Pitt kneeled down and studied the body more closely. His eyes squinted and his mouth tightened. It must have been almost as he had visualized, but not quite. The scorched form was curled in the fetus position, the knees drawn up almost to the chin and the arms pulled tightly against the sides, contracted by the intense heat upon the flesh. But there was something else that caught Pitt's attention. He focused the flashlight on the deck beside the body, illuminating dimly the twisted steel legs of the radio operator's chair where they protruded from beneath his disfigured remains. Honeywell, his face void of all color, asked, "What do you find so interesting in that grisly thing?" "Have a look," Pitt said. It would seem that poor Gustav was sitting down when he died. His chair literally burned out from under him. Honeywell said nothing, only eyed Pitt questioningly. "Doesn't it strike you as strange," Pitt continued, "that a man would calmly burn to death without bothering to stand up or make an effort to escape?" "Nothing strange about it," Honeywell said stonily. "The fire probably engulfed him while he was hunched over the transmitter sending out a mayday." He began to choke with sickness again. "God, we're not doing him any good with our conjectures. Let's get out of here and search the rest of the ship while I'm still able to walk." Pitt nodded and turned and passed through the doorway. Together they made their way into the bowels of the derelict. The engine room, the galley, the salon, everywhere they went, their eyes were laid on the same horrifying spectacle of death as in the radio room. By the time they discovered the 13th and 14th bodies in the wheelhouse, Honeywell's stomach was slowly becoming immune. He consulted his notebook several more times, marking certain pages with a pencil until only one name between the padded covers remained that didn't have a neat line drawn through it. "That's about it," he said, snapping the book shut. "We found them all except the man we came for." Pitt lit a cigarette and blew a long cloud of blue smoke and seemed to consider for a moment. They were all charred so far beyond recognition he could have been any one of them. "But he wasn't," Honeywell said positively. "The right body won't be too difficult to identify, at least not for me." He paused. "I knew our quarry rather well, you know." Pitt's eyebrows raised. "No, I didn't know." "No secret, really." Honeywell puffed on the lenses of his glasses and polished them with a handkerchief. "The man we've lied, schemed, and risked our lives to find, unfortunately, as it probably turns out, dead, attended one of my classes at the Oceanographic Institute 6 years ago. A brilliant fellow." He motioned toward the 2 cremated forms on the deck. "A pity if he ended like this." "How can you be certain you'll be able to tell him from the others?" Pitt asked. "By his rings. He had a thing about rings. Wore them on every finger except his thumbs." "Rings don't make a positive identification." Honeywell smiled a little. "There was also a toe missing from the left foot. Will that do?" "It would," Pitt said thoughtfully. "But we haven't found a corpse that qualifies. We've already searched the entire ship." "Not quite." Honeywell pulled a slip of paper from the notebook and unfolded it under the beam of his flashlight. "This is a rough diagram of the vessel. I traced a copy from the original in the Maritime Archives." He pointed at the creased paper. "See here, just beyond the chart room? A narrow ladder drops to a compartment directly beneath a false tunnel. It's the only entrance." Pitt studied the crude tracing. Then he turned and stepped outside the chart room. "The opening is here, all right. The ladder is burned all to hell, but enough of the rung bracing is left to support our weight." The isolated compartment, situated in the exact center of the hull without benefit of portholes, was ravaged even worse than the others. The steel plating on the walls curved outward, buckled like crinkled sheets of wallpaper. It appeared empty. No trace of anything that remotely resembled furnishings was left after the conflagration. Pitt was just kneeling down, poking the ashes, searching for a sign of a body, when Honeywell shouted,
"Here!"
He fell to his knees. "Over here in the corner." Honeywell focused the light on the sprawled outline of what had once been a man, now a barely discernible pile of charred bones. Only bits of the jawbone and pelvis were recognizable. Then he bent very low and carefully brushed away an area of the remains. When Honeywell stood up, he held several small pieces of distorted metal in his hand. "Not proof positive, perhaps, but about as certain as we'll ever get." Pitt took the fused bits of metal and held them under the beam of his light. "I remember the rings quite well," Honeywell said. "The settings were beautifully handcrafted and inlaid with 8 different semi-precious stones native to Iceland. Each was carved in the likeness of an ancient Nordic god."
"Sounds impressive, but garish," Pitt said.
"To you, a stranger, maybe," Honeywell returned quietly. "Yet if you had known him..." His voice trailed off. Pitt eyed Honeywell speculatively.
"Do you always form sentimental attachments to your students?"
"Genius, adventurer, scientist, legend. The 10th richest man in the world before he was 25. A kind and gentle person totally untouched by his fame and wealth. Yes, I think you could safely say a friendship with Christian Fury could result in a sentimental attachment."
How strange, Pitt thought.
It was the first time the scientist had mentioned Fury's name since they had left Washington. And it had been uttered in a hushed, almost reverent tone. The same inflection, Pitt recalled, that Admiral Sandecker had also used when he spoke of the Icelander. Pitt was conscious of no awe as he stood over the pitiful remains of the man who had been one of the most powerful figures in international finance. As he stood there staring down, his mind simply could not associate the ashes at his feet with the flesh-and-blood person the world's newspapers referred to as the apotheosis of the swinging intellectual jet-setter. Perhaps if he had met the celebrated Christian Fury, an emotion of some sort might be present now. But then Pitt truly doubted it. He wasn't one to impress easily. Take away the clothes of the greatest living man, his father once told him, and you behold a very embarrassed, naked, and defenseless animal. Pitt looked at the twisted metal rings for a moment and then passed them back to Honeywell, and as he did he heard the faint sound of movement somewhere on the deck above. He froze, listening intently. But the sound had died in the blackness beyond the upper hatchway. There was something sinister in the quality of the silence that hung over the devastated cabin, a feeling that someone was observing their every motion, listening to their every word. Pitt nerved himself for an act of defense, but it was too late. A powerful light beam played into the room from the top of the ladder, blinding his eyes in its blazing glare.
"Robbing the dead, gentlemen. By God, I do believe you two are capable of most anything."
The face was hidden behind the light, but the voice unmistakably belonged to Commander Koski.